We are both headphoneless.
We are.
It's liberating.
It's nice.
It is.
Nice to have my liberated ears.
Yeah, and Joe, who's behind the glass now, won't be able to speak to me and say, stop talking. Matt Haig, I love your new book. You know, because I've told you practically to your face, because we've known each other a while, that The Midnight Library is now up there as one of my favourite books of all time. You know, wow. I'm obsessed with it. I've read it three times. I give it to everybody as presents.
Wow.
It's a life-changing book.
So I owe you royalties.
That's where I'm coming to. Yeah, that's exactly, you knew what I was thinking. But thank you for the books. It was very interesting. The other day, so I go on the train a lot, do it for TV shows, and I was on the train reading Life Impossible, and this woman came up to me, and her name was Mary, and I was photographing the book to put on socials because I want everybody to read it. And she came up to me, she said, I hope you don't mind if I chat to you about, and I thought she was going to say about what I do. She said, about Matt Haig. So I said, of course you can. And she sat opposite me and she said, Matt Haig's book, The Midnight Library, have you ever read it? And I said, yes. And I give it to all my friends and I've read it three times because it's extraordinary and it's sort of mind-changing and life-changing. And she said that it changed her life. And I said, well, I'm actually seeing him in a couple of weeks. And she said, will you please say, Mary says thank you. So I didn't text you. I didn't message you. I didn't WhatsApp you. I wanted to say that to your face. Mary says thank you.
That is a lovely story. I mean, my mum is called Mary, so it might have been my mum. But
was it your mum? I don't think it was.
No, I don't think it was.
She was about the same age as you, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
So that would be really weird. But it was really sweet. And then she told me, which I won't share because on here, but she told me about things that she'd been through in her life. And she did think of times where she didn't want her life to be carry on.
Oh.
And she said that through The Midnight Library and through reading all your posts that she felt saved. We talked for quite a
while. Oh, wow. Well, no, that is lovely to hear that stuff. I mean, I am quite bad at absorbing it. And with A Midnight Library, I never really absorbed it because it came out during the pandemic and I never did a book tour, never met any readers from it. It was all very abstract. You'd get nice emails, obviously, about it and messages and stuff. But, you know, I never went out and physically did a tour. And so it's only been recently that I've been hearing those sort of things. And obviously, yeah, it's quite... It's lovely. It can be a bit too much sometimes, but it's lovely to absorb all.
Yeah, and of course it can be a bit much.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to tell you to your face.
No, that's very
nice. But with your new book as well, though, there's something extraordinary about some authors, because I read, it sounds really weird, I read publicly. You know what I mean? On trains and on tubes, I have my books on me.
Same here.
It makes me sound like some weird... I read publicly. I'm not a secret reader.
Yeah.
There we go. But it brings people...
Yeah, you don't invite people round to just look at you reading.
That'd be so
Gabby
weird.
Will be reading today.
I'm going to read. And just quietly to myself.
Yeah.
You can watch me. But some authors bring people together. And you do that. Is that what you think when you write?
I don't know what I think when I've been analysing it recently. I think certainly when I'm writing towards the sort of mental health stuff... I think subconsciously, because when I was depressed, and I still occasionally do go through patches of depression and anxiety, but when I was really, really depressed when I was younger and suicidal and stuff, the abiding thing I remember about that was the loneliness, the complete feeling that no one understood, very isolated. You know, you go back 20 plus years, you didn't really have accessible stuff on TV or in books that you could access. That has, thankfully, changed a lot now. But I think, so subconsciously, when I'm writing, I'm not just writing to try and be of use to other people or to help them. That is very nice to do that, and that is an incentive. But it's also because I felt alone for so long, but it's nice to have a kind of community of people who are... like you have gone through something similar, who understand you. We all want to be understood, don't we? So I think books are a way you can do that, whether writing or reading them, it's to sort of like understand ourselves.
And then when you... So that's interesting. You said that you don't really know what you think when you're writing them. Obviously, you're thinking about the book and whether...
Yeah, but it's not like
You don't think about the impact.
No, you just think, what's going to be a good book and what do you want to write? And I think I always try and write the book I want to read, you know, in that moment. You know, you're trying to sort of feel, and you don't want it to be a book that's already there because that book's already there. So you're trying to think of a book that doesn't exist that you want to read is the best sort of way to do it. But, yeah, I think, you know, it's a massive cliche, isn't it, that writing is therapy. But I think for me it is a kind of therapy, because you take something very internal and you put it into words. I mean, that's what therapy is. You're talking, or writing to a therapist, and or journaling or whatever you're doing. But you're putting a very personal, wordless experience into words, and it then automatically, even if no one's reading it, it kind of becomes a shared thing, because that you put it into language and it's shared and it's open. So it's almost like, I don't know, like a metaphorical kidney stone or something that you're taking out, and you're taking out and externalizing this impossibly internal thing. And I think there is a therapy in that. So, you know, I'd recommend anyone, even if you find it hard to speak about it, even if you don't want an audience for it, to actually get a journal open, write down what you're feeling. I did that when I was advised by my partner, Andrea, years and years and years ago when I was going through depression. I could literally hardly speak. I mean, there were times where my sort of like throat was dried up, my tongue wouldn't move.
Mentally
and physically, it was kind of the same thing. I was literally like a zombie. There's photos of me at that time where my whole face looks like slack and loose because I just couldn't speak. But I could write down very slowly what I was feeling. And, you know, you wouldn't want to read that stuff. It's like the lyrics of the worst heavy metal song ever written, you know, lots of fire and ravens and things. But it was all just what I was feeling like at that time. And just that act, there was a lightening that goes on when you do it. So I think words, you know, words are therapy, and putting your own experience into words in whatever form, whether it's talking in a podcast, whether it's writing it for no one to see, or whatever you're doing, there's a kind of therapy to it.
It's very interesting. When my mum died almost 28 years ago, I remember somebody saying to my dad, because he also had cancer, and she died of cancer and he survived. And somebody said to him, Clive, write down how you feel. And he said, he was a broadcaster, write down how you feel. And he said, what do you mean? And he did. And they said to him, now just fold it away or tear it up or burn it or stamp on it, whatever. It was just how you felt. And I remember him ringing me up and saying, do you know what I found? Something's wonderful. If you write it down and then you get rid of it, it lightens you. And it was, and he was a young man. My mum died very young. And it was suddenly that. I'd always loved that. I mean, I like writing and I love reading. But hearing somebody who was straighter and hadn't done that before, it was amazing. Just a simple, so simple.
I totally understand. Yeah. My mum used to keep my mum's still around, but she used to keep a 5-year diary.
Yeah. Wow.
So they used to have these like 5-year diaries that she used to sort of lock up. And when me and my sister were young, she unfortunately went through quite severe postnatal depression. And she would write it, she'd be very honest. She, you know, the one place she could be honest was in the diary about what she was feeling and what medication she took or whatever. But because it was a 5-year diary, so even if she was feeling a bit bad the year later, she could look back at a worse day and then see the progress she was making
isn't
over
that
the
incredible?
5 years. Because the days were on top of each other. So March the 12th, 1975 would be there, and then March the 12th, 1976 would be there. And she'd see.
What a wonderful thing to do!
Yeah. Yeah.
It's very interesting because I go on and on and on about living in the moment. And I mean, everything that you write, whether it's on social media, because I love what you write on social media, and I love your books, as you know, but living in the moment is something I just really wanted to talk to you about, because I personally believe that if we all think too much about the past, then everybody gets bogged down and, I wish that hadn't happened, or I wish he hadn't gone, or I wish that I had got that job, whatever it is. And if you think too much about what's going to happen in a year, you don't know what's going to happen in a year. But it's living right now, and every time you put your foot down, you feel the ground, you think, wow, I'm not going to do that footstep again. I just wondered how you feel about that, about living today in this second, in this moment.
Yeah, I'm someone who's struggled to do that.
Yeah.
I mean, as a younger person, I was living in a hypothetical all the time. So I was, you know, depression gives you just pessimistic versions of your future all the time. And so I think now I'm always consciously, not fighting it, but moving the tide against that, because that pessimism was wrong. You know, people are very cynical about hope and happiness and optimism and social media. And sometimes, you know, there's good reasons for that. There's a lot of hollow be kind out there, which you know, from people that you think, you're not always that kind. But, you know, so there's a right reason I understand why people can be cynical about optimism. But for me, I'm more cynical about pessimism, because pessimism in my life was so wrong. My pessimism told me I would be dead at the age of 25. I am now, surprise, surprise, older than 25. I'm 49 years old. And, you know, it said if I stayed around somehow, I'd be in a straitjacket, or this would happen, or everyone you love would turn against you. And obviously life isn't a bed of roses and bad things happen to everybody.
Yeah.
And it's a roller coaster and it's up and down. But that view of total bleakness was not the future for me. And even if you're stuck in depression, even if you've got chronic depression, things can change. Perspective changes, different things change, treatments change. There's always change. So life is change. And change can be scary, but change is also hope. You know, if you're stuck in a bad place, change is good and life is change. So if you hold on long enough, if you're stuck in a situation that is terrible, you know, like that U2 song, Stuck in the Moment, that used to play in my head because that's a powerful thought I used to have about being stuck in a moment. But you're never stuck in that moment forever.
See, I that everything that you say always makes me think more. And that's why I love your writing. Do you do talk? I know you do book tours, but do you ever do talks? Do you ever go out there and just talk? Because you talk so wonderfully.
I've done it before. I don't like being on a stage on my own. I'd be fine if us two were sitting on a stage right now. I'd be fine with that. I'd just be chatting like this. I'm fine at chatting on a stage.
But TEDx talks and all of that.
Oh, good Lord. Yes. And also just that I really admire interviewers, because that's the hard bit. The sort of like, because you've got to keep various things in your head, haven't you, when you're interviewing. So when you're the interviewee, you're just being led. You're just being handheld through the conversation. But to actually go out there on a stage, which I did, I foolishly did, because I had a thing, this was back in 2019, and I was asked to do a tour, and they said, do you want to be with someone, like in different venues? Sorry, I'm coughing. Or do you want to talk yourself? And because I was scared of talking myself, I had this foolish thing about things I was scared of, I've got to do. So I said, yes, yeah. I'll do the
face your fears.
Face your fears, because that's always what, and I did face my fears, and I'm glad I went through it. But it was like the world's worst TED talk, because I'm really bad at technology, and because I've got ADHD, I can't really focus enough to be like an actor and remember a script or remember. So what I did was I remembered a sequence of slides in the presentation, but every night the slides went wrong. And then I'd be like,
oh, no. No one wants that. And
so I get so scared. So I think I'm better actually just in a natural conversation. And also because I was a nervous sort of young person, my mum used to send me to try and correct that to like speech and drama classes and things like that. All of that makes me feel like I'm back as a nervous 13-year-old.
Isn't it interesting?
Recite a poem or something.
We go back to that 13-year-old self. So if you and I were now 13, I couldn't speak. I was the shyest person, except I knew I wanted to be a TV presenter so nobody could understand it, but I couldn't speak.
Can I just ask you, I know it's your podcast asking me, but can I just ask you, what was your change from shy Gabby to...
No, I still am.
You really
are. I talk very openly about it. I still am.
Yeah.
Don't make me ever go to a house party, because I can't go to parties.
Oh, that's so comforting, because I hate that.
I hold my husband's hand really tight, and if he says he's going to the loo, I go, don't you dare go to the loo. No. But I love what I do. So I think you're the same. You love what you do.
Mm.
I think we're lucky to have found something that we're passionate about.
Yeah, I'd really be scared if it didn't, because I don't know. I mean, I started writing because I had such social anxiety amid my sort of panic disorder. I could not have gone out and done a 9-to-5. And, you know, I was lucky that I had parents where I could live at their house, but we had no, you know, we were in debt. We had to do something to go out there and earn money. And the only thing I had was writing. So it sounds ridiculous, but that was my most solid choice to do. So, yeah.
It doesn't sound ridiculous at all. Makes total sense.
Yeah, in the sense that it's kind of hard to, A, write a book and then try and turn that into a career.
Career is
quite tricky.
But I love that you did that. So when did the anxiety, the big anxiety, if we can call it that, not the regular stuff that most kids have, when did that all kick in?
Well, you were talking like, teenage years, I had a lot of it, but I didn't know it. I didn't have the ability to know what was going on. I mean, it's only recently when you get sort of diagnosed with things like ADHD and autism, which I still haven't come to terms with. I mean, I had those diagnoses, but I don't see myself as that. But so life's just a journey of understanding yourself. As a teenager, I obviously had issues going on because I was a problem for my parents. I was a shoplifter. I had massive mood swings. I know that's a standard teenage thing, but I was slightly off the scale sometimes. I was told by teachers I was special needs. I got arrested for shoplifting at the age of 16. I was a problem for my parents, and I have a lot of guilt about that time. But I wouldn't say I had the full-blown anxiety that I ended up having at 24, because that felt like entering a different world. You think of a panic attack's 10 minutes. This was a panic attack that lasted 3 years of just being in that. So my 20s were dominated by that. I was very lucky in the sense that my parents were there for me. I had a partner who was there for me. So I had three people who were properly there for me, and they weren't pressuring me to be something I wasn't at that moment.
It wasn't ever pull yourself together. Well, come on, pull yourself together.
I mean, there were moments of frustration, and there were moments I was telling myself to pull myself together, and I'm sure my dad did utter those words at one point, but it was in a very much like they'd run out of things to say. You know, come on, Matt. You know, there's ways you can say things, aren't there?
Yeah, yes.
And I think sometimes, and I've fallen cropper to this as well, you know, when you get told off for using the wrong words about things and stuff, I think it's more about intention. Like with my dad, he didn't have all the right words of a politically correct language, but he cared, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He was doing it, you know what I mean? And I think...
He was doing it from a really good place.
Place, and he didn't come with all the answers or knew what I should do. So, I mean, the one thing my dad did, and of course it's not a wonder cure, but my dad's always been a runner, and he's always done marathons and stuff. And so one thing that helped in the very early days was just going out with my dad running. And it wasn't like it got rid of my anxiety or depression, but what it did was, because running, you're obviously breathless and your heart is racing. It's very hard to have a panic attack while you're running because you are having the symptoms of a panic attack while you're running. So just having that every day and being able to talk to my dad was a sort of a little safe space. And that was like, you know, when people say, oh, it's all in, you know, it's all in your head, or they don't believe anxiety and depression or whatever, and they think it's something everyone has. That was definitely, you know, when you've crossed the line into something that's sort of serious illness. And that was like, oh, because I myself had been someone who didn't really believe what depression was. I thought it was just feeling sad.
Yeah, and lots of people use it. They go, oh, I'm so depressed today.
Yeah. And that's fine. But, you know, depression itself is something very different, and panic, you know, and so, like in my case, it wasn't a conscious thing of, oh, I've weighed up my life and, you know, I'm suicidal now. It was like, I still want to live. I just can't cope with this situation that I'm in, and I can't get out of it. And so I think, but I would love that to change around the conversation, and it's been, you know, happening in the media recently as well, around suicide. I still think we talk a lot about it, and we talk a lot about mental health, but I think we're fundamentally missing an understanding of it. There's always a sort of slightly moral dimension to it, and I think people don't realize that suicide doesn't always feel like a choice. And simply saying, oh, well, you've got people to stay alive for or anything else, it is kind of victim blaming. Because when you're going through an illness, and suicide might be the last symptom of that illness for some unfortunate people, then it doesn't help to add more stigma and add more shame. I think we you know, get people to stay alive by understanding and by compassion and by encouraging people to understand that this situation they're in won't always be the situation they're in.
I met some amazing young people recently because I'm doing stuff on loneliness, and they were early 20s and they had all attempted suicide. And they all sat around and talked all about the different reasons. But it's interesting because the word they used was compassion, and there needs to be more compassion.
Yeah.
And they were the most uplifting, wonderful young people. They were all mad about books. That's what brought them all together.
Oh, that's lovely.
There we go. But it was about compassion. And I think, and I know it's a really sort of, it's a sweeping statement, but I think everybody feels it at the moment around the world. And the news that we all get 24 hours, however you get it, whether it's
a lot. It's a lot. It's a whole generation now. I mean, I'm a father of teenagers.
Yes.
They've had their struggles. I can't think of any of her friends who haven't had their struggles. We're in a world now that's almost, couldn't be designed better for anxiety.
Oh, my word. And we don't see compassion.
No.
We hear about the bad news. For want of putting it any other way, we hear about the bad news. We hear about the bad things that are happening around the world. And goodness me, we need some good things that are happening. We need to hear about those good things. Because otherwise, you use the word hope. We both use the word hope a lot. Where is the hope if all we're being fed is that negative stuff?
No. Well, you know, negative stuff goes on, but even within the negative stuff, I always think it's useful to like look for the helpers, you know, look for with any situation. And there are tough situations all the time, but there's always compassion within that. And yeah, you're right. I mean, news, somewhere along the line, we decided that news was just the worst things that are happening everywhere. But, you know, important, significant things that are happening in people's lives all the time are hopeful, compassionate things that are happening. And yeah, I just think we need to be a bit more gentle with each other. I think one thing about the internet is we've forgotten that the people we're dealing with are effectively people like us. Everyone is a context. And yes, bad behavior exists and, you know, bad things exist. But, you know, if we, you wonder how many of these sort of internet arguments would disappear if we literally could transport ourselves into other people's contexts.
Oh, wouldn't it be? I mean, I'd like to know what makes some people say that. Maybe I just do live in a happy place, happy land, but I think that a lot of people who say the nasty things online, I think it's about them. It's not about the person that they're writing the horrible things to.
Yeah.
I mean, there was some really horrible stuff said to Katie Piper recently, which was really nasty. And that she had to read that about. It was horrible, and I'm not going to repeat it. But she called them out, and she put it on her social media.
Yeah,
and
she's great. She's so
incredible,
strong,
Katie.
At that stuff.
But that was probably about that person. They weren't thinking, I'm going to be really cruel and nasty to her. Yeah. But they were thinking, there's something in their life that's not right.
Yes. And it's hard when you're an insecure person, necessarily, like I'm speaking about myself now, but like when you've had anxiety yourself and you're not necessarily thinking you're that great yourself. And then if someone else is saying it, then it really, that's when really it really gets in.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so dangerous. And I think we need to see this stuff, you know, just as we've had laws about passive smoking and whatever else it is, we need to get an understanding that this stuff is a health issue. It's an actual health issue. Trolling is a health issue. The internet is a health issue. Social media. It's not about banning things. It's about an intention, a grown-up discussion about it, about what's good for us. And, you know, we're all, you know, the genie's out of the bottle. We're all on social media and all of that. But within that, we need a serious conversation about how we go forward, I think.
You're so right. I think you should lead it.
I don't know.
You should lead that conversation.
I wouldn't be very organised. I'd be too addicted to my... I'd be too much scrolling to actually get anything done. I'd be on Instagram.
I want to change it, but hold on a minute.
I'll just look at this meme.
Have a look.
About this
goat. Who do you read? What books do you read?
I'm really eclectic. I read all kinds of stuff. I mean, like, you know, everything. I'll read Elton John's biography. I'll read a book on philosophy. I'll read an old, you know, like Victorian classic by, you know, whoever, Emily Bronte. I'll read an old Graham Greene novel. I'll read a thriller. I've just read The Silent Patient, which is brilliant. I read all kinds of stuff. I'm quite a bad reader, though, in the sense that...
Bad reader?
Well, what I mean is I'm not very faithful. So I'll have a pile of books and I'll flit, you know, between them, because I've got my attention spans. As anyone who's read any of my books or my short chapters will realise, I probably don't have the best attention span. So I'll go from one book until I get hit slow a bit, and then I pick up another book and I switch between non-fiction.
Are you able to retain the story, the one you put down?
Sometimes and sometimes not, but I definitely am an unfinisher. There's lots of books I don't finish. Mm. There's old children's books I sometimes pick up. My favourite book of all time is The House at Pooh Corner, A.A. Milne. I honestly think...
Good choice.
The Winnie the Pooh universe is one... Because A.A. Milne himself, you know, we think of him as this sort of gentle children's writer, but he'd been through war. He was sort of like in the woods when he wrote that, and he was sort of overcoming his own trauma. And I see the Winnie the Pooh stuff as kind of mental health.
Oh, it really is.
Because you've got like... Piglet with anxiety, you've got Eeyore with depression, you've got Tigger with whatever else, with ADHD.
ADHD, without a doubt.
Thing. You've got Pooh, who's addicted to honey and happiness, and you've got Christopher Robin, who's hallucinating the whole thing. But no, you've got like, you've got a whole world to escape in. And that was my comfort read. When I was really depressed, I couldn't read anything, I couldn't watch TV, I couldn't go to the movies, but one thing I could read was... The House at Pooh Corner, which was funny because I'd just done this degree in English literature where we've been told, you know, to value just the most complicated, highbrow stuff. And the only thing I could actually read when so after that, I left my sort of highbrow pretentiousness and realised, no, you just want to communicate. You just want to sort of like create little nice, gentle worlds for people.
Do you know, I'm now going to go back and read it. I mean, I've read bits of it, but I haven't actually sat down to read it from beginning to end. I haven't done that for years. I'm going to do that. Thank you. That's the one thing you've left me with. Thank you very much. And your book. Let's talk about the new book. It's so incredible. I don't know what you do. I've got a very vivid imagination. I always have had, but I close my eyes and I'm in your book. That's a really weird thing, but I'm doing it now. So I'm there. I'm in Ibiza. I'm in all those places. It's very visual what you write. It's a book about hope. I know there's bits in it but it really, to me, it's a book about hope. I finished it 2 days ago.
Oh yeah. No, it was. It's about hope and it's about impossible things happening, which is why it's called The Life Impossible. And it's about it was. A very personal book in a strange way, even though the narrator is a 72-year-old widow, former maths teacher. So nothing like me on paper. But because when I was suicidal, after years of depression, after drink, after drugs, after everything else, in Ibiza 25 years ago, to write a novel set in this place I'd escaped from, never wanted to think about, everyone's got their cliches about parties and dance music and stuff, and to actually sort of focus on it and focus on a very different side of the island as well. That was kind of a therapy for me, as was going back there to Spain, to that particular part of Spain, to the cliffs in Ibiza where I nearly died, to the hospital where I was prescribed diazepam to get on a plane home, all of that. And then to actually just really focus on the place where I'd been ill, and then find the joy in it and find the sort of nature and the calm peace in it was really, for me, it really was writing as therapy.
Well, thank you for the book. It's really bizarre. There are some books, if I close my eyes, in the same with the Midnight Library, and I'm mentioning it again, that if I close my eyes, I'm there. What is it like to see your stuff come to life in the films and things?
Well, I'm still, like, because I was a struggling writer for a long time, I didn't sort of, like, find an instant hit or anything. Midnight Library was, like, something like book number 22 or something ridiculous. I wrote a lot of unread books early on in my career. So even if I see my book in a bookshop, I'm still incredibly grateful for that. So anything that happens from the moment I've sent off the manuscript, you know, I'm just very grateful for it. I'm actually happy that I had a struggle at the start in terms of my career, because I think if you go in and you're like superstar New York Times bestseller from the first book, then where do you go? You don't have a sense of a career, you know, development. And so I try and be very grateful and philosophical about it, you know, the good reviews, bad reviews, things happening. And obviously, yeah, like if they turn something into a film, that's surreal, but you have to at the same time know it's there, you are the impetus, but then it becomes something else, and that's great. And as soon as you signed off on it, you don't think too much about it or you'll go insane. And then, you know, and you just focus on what you're doing and the writing and writing the next one and try and have fun with it. I mean, the thing that doesn't change, whether you're an unknown, unpublished writer and you're writing your first manuscript, or whether you're like 90 years old and you've written 100 books, the thing that doesn't change is the writing. And you have to kind of enjoy at least part of that writing thing, because that's the thing. If you're a writer, you're a writer because you write, not because of any of the other stuff that happens. So it's about the writing.
How does it feel to read how many people have read your books? Is that really, is it extraordinary in a good way?
It is. Yeah, it's cool. Yeah.
I mean, the millions and millions and millions, you sort of can't see those people.
No. And it's been very nice to sort of like do some international things recently. Like I've just, you know, yesterday I was in Germany and then I've been in Canada recently.
Around the world.
America.
Everybody knows you, Matt. They love your book. The world loves you.
It's it's hard to absorb, but at the same time, I am getting better. I think if you just, what you obviously numbers and stuff are abstract, but what I like is like when you told me that story about Mary that you spoke to, is when a person comes up to you and you can look that person in the eye and then you think, okay, that's a person who's read my book, enjoyed my book, or it helped them in some way, or... Yeah, slightly scary when they say, like, with Midnight Library, oh, I quit my job because of that book, and, you know, you think, oh, in a good way. So, yeah. But, when it's a one-to-one, like, it doesn't happen very much to writers, but occasionally you get stopped in the street and someone says something to you, then that's lovely, yeah. I can deal with a one-to-one. But, yeah, thinking about the whole thing gets a little bit like, wow, that's a bit much.
When I left home this morning, and it's half term, and my younger daughter was there, and I said I was coming to chat to you, and she said, honestly, she looked at me, she went, oh God, do you think you should tell him that you're his cheerleader? Because everyone was of the family, I think I'm mad. It's as if I'm just, give me an M, give me an A. I have these little, because everyone, so I'm saying that from my daughter to you. Oh. If you need a cheerleader to sort of walk down the street before you, so everybody can come up and talk to you with your million-selling books.
No, you've been lovely, Gabby.
No, I'm so not supportive. No, I just think you're fantastic.
Yeah, it's surreal when people like, when I was drunk and depressed student watching The Big Breakfast. And then
you've been so kind and lovely to me. Matt, thank you.
Thank you, Gabby.
Total joy.
No, you too. It's lovely. Thank you.